Soul searching for Democrats in the wake of a disastrous election.
The reason I'm so critical of the Democratic Party's philosophy and approach is not because I don't think there are other things, external things, that caused Hillary Clinton's loss, but the reason I focus on what Democrats are doing wrong is because that's the stuff Democrats can change. And we can't affect what the FBI does, we can't affect what Russia does, we can't really affect what Republicans do, but we can definitely look at what we do and change that.
That's Nathan Robinson. We spend the hour with him talking about his book, Trump, Anatomy of a Monstrosity. This is Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. The Democratic National Committee will be meeting on February 23rd to 26th to choose a new head of the DNC. Will the DNC delegates choose reformer Keith Ellison, who's pledged, as he says, to empower the grassroots and fight for the issues that improve people's lives? Or will they choose Tom Perez, the candidate widely seen as the candidate of the Clinton-Obama wing, less friendly to change? To be fair, there are others in the running as well, but those are the two major contenders. The issue is less about the qualifications of both candidates, both are liked and respected, and more about the willingness of the Democrats to reorient the party to better reflect the interests of its base rather than those of its corporate donors. The Democrats need look no farther than my guest Nathan Robinson's book, Trump, Anatomy of a Monstrosity. As editor-in-chief of the bimonthly periodical Current Affairs, Robinson has been one of my go-to guys for incisive analysis of the political landscape. And he writes really, really well. More than just a book about the new president himself, Trump, Anatomy of a Monstrosity, is about the forces that led to his political existence. The book takes a close look at why progressives failed to stop his election and outlines how ordinary people can fight back against Trumpism and win. Nathan Robinson is editor-in-chief of Current Affairs. He's also the author of The Man Who Accidentally Wore His Cravat to a Gymnasium, a children's book about fashion and conformity. Nathan Robinson, welcome to Writer's Voice. This book, first of all, I want to say, I think it's possibly the most important book that anybody could read post-election about what to do now going ahead. And it's a very detailed analysis of what went wrong, of how Donald Trump got elected, and also how the Democrats lost the election. It's not really about Donald Trump as a human being, as you say, it's about him as a phenomenon. Talk a little bit more about the scope of the book.
So there are a lot of biographies of Donald Trump at this point. There are about something close to 20 books about him as a man. But I'm more concerned with understanding the sort of political forces that led to him becoming president of the United States, which is sort of one of the most startling historical events in recent memory. And so what the book does is it has four parts, really. And the first part is a biography of him, because it's important to understand his background, where he came from, how he sort of developed and became a person poised to enter the national politics suddenly at the age of 70. The second part is about how the election happened. It's about his candidacy, how he crafted his message. It's about the primary and how he dominated in a large Republican field and then proceeded to destroy Hillary Clinton during the general election. The third part is sort of interpreting what that means, what the implications are for how we understand where the parties are at, where American politics is at, and what might happen now. And then the fourth part is, I mean, this is a book pitched at a progressive audience, and it's a discussion of what people can do now, where things ought to go, how we ought to start rethinking politics and moving forward after this sort of tremendously shocking moment.
Now, you do take some time talking about him, and You divide him into what you say the four core qualities. And I think these are really important and interesting because I think so much of the press and of the opposition really spend a whole lot of time and ink in making fun of him. But you say he's not so much funny as scary. You say his qualities are ego, revenge, prejudice, and I'm going to have to bleep some of this out. Bullshit.
Sure. BS. Let's say BS.
Right. So let's start with the ego. Ego and the revenge, because I think they're very much linked.
Well, the first thing I think that is important to know if we're trying to understand Donald Trump as a human being is that it's almost impossible to do so because so much of it is kind of this blurring between an act that he's putting on, a character he's kind of been playing, and himself. So it's difficult to kind of get at the real Donald Trump, which is what a lot of people have been trying to do for a long time. So you have to kind of assume that his public persona is his real persona, but at the same time cognizant that nobody really knows what's going on in his mind. But if you do assess his public statements, the books that have been published under his name, and the sort of character that he's created, you can see some running themes in what this persona is. The first is obviously ego. Donald Trump has been the symbol of American egotism since the 80s when he first became a prominent public person. And he really pushes that. But this idea that you should tell yourself that you're the greatest, everyone else is a loser, you're a winner. Donald Trump is a person who has consistently throughout the course of his career an emphasis on not just self over others, but almost treating others as non-existent, from the way he treated tenants during the 80s to the way he treated contractors on his casino projects to the way in which he has sort of used voters to his advantage. He really has perfected the art of total devotion to ego and to self over others. I mean, there was an incredible investigation by the Washington Post into his supposed philanthropic activities over the course of his long career. And it's really quite startling what he's done, which is create the image of charity as much as possible with as little of the reality as possible. So, I mean, he would promise the world to all these charitable organizations, but as soon as the cameras turn off, he's gone. And there is a real conscious attempt to do everything possible to seem as great as possible, but at no point taking any act that might help another person at his own expense if that is not going to be something that gets publicity and that inflates the public's image of him.
You even go back to his childhood. It's pretty striking. You know, he used to use toddlers as target practice for throwing stones at them, and neighborhood parents forbade their kids to play with him because he was known to be a bully who carried a switchblade.
Yeah, in fact, that was one of the sort of more alarming things, I think, reading about his biography and background is, you know, you'd almost like to think that underneath it all, like, everyone was once a child, everyone was once pure and innocent. Well, it turns out that as a child, he was in fact loathed by and feared by his peers and even by his teachers, his second grade teacher. We have a quote in there saying, even back then, Donald Trump was a little blank. And that's his second grade teacher who said, who supposedly he actually hit at one point. So even as a child, Donald Trump was known for that same personality, that constant pushing of his own greatness and that constant denigration and bullying of other people and weaker people especially. In fact, at school there are people that he beat up who are smaller than him. And so you really do see that kind of lack of empathy from very early on. And I think it's one of the frightening qualities about him.
You know, what's also interesting in what you say is that it's impossible to know the real Donald Trump, and yet that's his Twitter handle, the real Donald Trump.
So yes.
What you're really describing is someone who is more than anything else a con man, and a consummate con man.
And really a brilliant one. I mean, I really do think that people... I mean, one of the things that I push over and over in this book is that people shouldn't underestimate Trump's abilities in that respect. So there are different kinds of intelligence, and I think people assume that because he doesn't have one kind of intelligence, because he doesn't read books and he's not a worldly or particularly literate man, that he doesn't have any kind of intelligence. But that's not in fact true. I mean, ordinary con men and salespeople are often, you know, not highly educated people, but they're very skilled at pitching things. And as a salesman and as a builder of brands and as an entertainer, he really is one of the greatest at these particular things in recent American history. I mean, he is singular in his ability to craft an image and sell it to people.
But then also the part where you say that he stands for impunity, the notion that you can get away with absolutely anything. You know, you could call that the absolute art of the con, but it's also the con of the American dream in a way. I wonder if you could talk about Donald Trump, not only sui generis, but how he expresses something very deep in American society.
Yeah, so I talk about Trump University a little bit in order to illustrate this point, where Trump University was not a real university, as everyone kind of knows now, but what it did was it promised people something that it didn't deliver. And it took all these people who really wanted to strike it rich and who wanted to be successful, and it told them essentially the story of the American dream. And it used that language explicitly. It said, imagine having time to spend with your kids, imagine having a nice house, you know, imagine getting to go and pick them up from soccer practice. It really used that kind of language. And then until people handed over their savings, and then at that point, they realized that they were going to get nothing, that they were left with, you know, they got to take their picture with a cardboard cutout of Donald Trump, but that was about it. It squeezed them dry and offered nothing in return. And I think that's something that has parallels in American capitalism, where people are fed the story that if they work hard and if they buy into the product that is America, they will have everything they want, they'll have a prosperous and happy life, and at the end people work all their lives and they're often left finding out that that's not true, especially in an age of rising inequality, because that's only true in an age of real social mobility where people can advance, they can achieve their dreams. And so I think what Donald Trump sold at Trump University and then sold on the national political stage was illustrative of something about the contemporary American age of inequality, which tells working people who are very desperate, who don't know what to do, but who still have dreams, that if they buy into something, if they sacrifice everything they have, then all of their dreams will come true. And that's kind of what Donald Trump did on the campaign trail. You know, vote for me, I'll make America great again, come along with me and you can have everything. But it turns out that the only person who wins in the end is Donald Trump. And that is consistently true throughout his life. And he gets away with it. The reason I talk about impunity is that he's done things that for any other person would have ruined them over and over and over. But he gets away with it because he's the most brazen and because he's totally unwilling to do anything that would require him. If there's ever an opportunity to take advantage of another person, he will take it. And if you're willing to do that, if you're shameless enough, if you're immoral enough, it turns out you could come out on top. And so Donald Trump offers a real kind of ugly story of a truth about America, which is that it's not the most decent and hardworking people necessarily who get to the top. Often it's the most venal and greedy people who are the most willing to hurt other people in the pursuit of their own agenda.
And now it's not just him who's actually winning out, but it is a whole class of what we could call the swamp, the most predatory capitalists of predatory capitalism. And you point out in your book, Nathan Robinson, you point out in Anatomy of a Monstrosity, a brilliant title, by the way.
It's striking, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. You point out that really the swamp cabinet that he has nominated is probably not different than the cabinet that would have been nominated by any one of his Republican rivals like Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio, for that matter, or even possibly Bush.
Yeah, it might even be worse, right? Because they really are on the very far right of the spectrum. Or, I mean, the drain the swamp thing, I think, is fascinating. A fascinating illustration of exactly what I'm talking about with these sort of false promises to the working class, where, I mean, he said it all through the campaign. He said, I'm going to go to Washington, drain the swamp. You know, I'm going to fight for the working class. He had a campaign that was very pitched at working people, at jobs, at it was populist, it was anti-establishment. And then he gets to Washington and it's all false, right? I mean, you know, a bunch of people in the cabinet are from Goldman Sachs. Quite a few of them are not just billionaires, but they're the children of billionaires, meaning they've never known a time in their life where they weren't extremely rich. His cabinet is disproportionately full of the sort of people who are the most out of touch possible people with the lives of the working class because they've never even experienced it. And so you can see that it's all this kind of false promise. In fact, I think the real truth about Donald Trump is that he's going to turn out kind of to be almost an orthodox Republican politician. I mean, he's more vulgar, he's more shameless, but at the same time, I think you're going to find that aside from maybe on trade and on foreign policy, there's going to be a continuity with establishment Republican politics, because it is all a big con. He's not a real populist, he's not a friend of the working class. He's a billionaire, and he's a particularly effective salesman.
I want to ask you this question. It comes up because of what you just said. I'm curious whether you think that the Republicans, I think, are very clearly exploiting him, or they think they can exploit him. But do you think that Donald Trump might actually ruin the Republican brand, or do you think that they're just going to ride off into the sunset together?
It's hard to know, and one of the reasons it's difficult to know is that some of that depends entirely on what Democrats do. Because right now, there was all this speculation during the campaign that Donald Trump would undo the Republican Party. The suggestion that if they nominated him, he was going to take the whole party down in flames because he made them look ridiculous, he was extreme. Well, actually, the opposite happened. The Republican Party now has full control of Congress. They have massive control at the state level of both state legislatures and governorships. And they've got the presidency. So it depends. I mean, it might be that his presidency turns out to be so bad for the people he promised that he would make their lives better again that they quickly get disillusioned with him. But that's only going to make a difference if it's true that Democrats then present a viable and compelling alternate option, right? Because otherwise their disillusionment isn't going to lead them to vote Democratic. It's just going to lead them to be angry at the president. They are going to be primed to be taken to listen to an anti-Trump message. But unless that message is conveyed very well and by a political organization, it's not going to undo the Republican Party, because the Republican Party has a lot of power right now. And it's hard to see how they will implode without someone actually stepping in to replace them.
So that is in line with your book, Nathan Robinson, Anatomy of a Monstrosity. Let's move now to why did Donald Trump win? And we're going to get to what the Democrats did wrong, because I think that that's a very crucial part of your book, at least if we want to make sure that we can actually do something to defeat the Republicans and Donald Trump next time around. But I think there's been a whole lot of people who are really blaming Trump voters. And you say that it's, quite simplistic to just denigrate the deplorable. So I wonder if you could deconstruct the different reasons that Trump won.
Yeah, I mean, it's very, there's obviously everything has a lot of causes. So, I don't want to single out or isolate one particular thing and say that that's what it is. But I talk about a few things that I think are important to consider. And the first thing is that if we treat Trump as a con man or a salesman, then usually we don't blame people who fall victim to false promises and lose their savings, right? The people who are taken advantage by Trump University, those people aren't to blame. And in the same way, I think Trump was very strategic in taking people who were anxious and afraid and didn't really have and susceptible to a particular kind of messaging, and telling those people, all of your fears, all of your troubles, I can solve them. Come with me. I know what's good for you. And so he's a very gifted manipulator and propagandist. And so that sort of complicates the idea that it's these Trump voters who are just have a certain set of values. They recognize that Trump embodies this value. Trump is preying on people. He's preyed on people all his life. Now, at the same time, you know, every generalization you can make is true to some degree. So it's true that people who have racial prejudices are much more likely to be Trump voters. People who have sexist prejudice are much more likely to be Trump voters. That accounts for a segment of his support. But then there's other groups of people that are people who don't have jobs, or people who have a lot of debt, or people who just feel abandoned. They've watched their towns be hollowed out over the course of the last 20 years. There's people who are doing okay, but they feel a real cultural divide and a contempt from coming from sort of wealthy coastal America. And those people are not necessarily bigoted people. They are people who don't really know what to do because they're disillusioned with politics as it is. And the Democratic Party has kind of given up on appealing to large segments of the populace. And they were primed to listen to what Trump had to sell. And he was very effective at that. I mean, I recommend that people watch some videos of the rallies that he did, because I think anyone who has a picture of people just as being deplorables doesn't quite understand what happened at those rallies. They see the highlights on the news, but they don't see that at the rallies, Trump was very charismatic. He was very friendly. He was very likable, even. He was funny. He would tell jokes. That so much of it was joke telling. And he'd give speeches that were very focused on jobs and keeping you safe, very focused on closing the border, obviously, and on bombing ISIS. But also, you know, this sense of warmth and I understand you and I can take care of you. And that's something that's a formidable appeal and that he really does have.
Okay, so now we can say that the Trump voter is not a monolith, and that the racists are not necessarily the main part. I mean, they may even be a small majority, that there could be far more people. And I can certainly say among my own acquaintance that is true. In fact, I knew people who voted for Trump who would have voted for Bernie Sanders if he had been an option. So now let's move to the Democrats. Why did Hillary Clinton lose?
Well, Hillary Clinton lost for a lot of reasons. One of the reasons was that they underestimated Trump from the beginning. They had a bad strategy in a lot of different respects. They didn't understand what was being said by some people. Like Michael Moore wrote something in July, I think, where he said, Trump is going to win, and he's going to win entirely because of the Rust Belt states. He's going to appeal to the working class in Michigan, Wisconsin, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. And that's how he's going to win, and that's all it's going to take. And unless Hillary Clinton's campaign understands that right now and works to fix that, they're going to lose. And it turns out that is exactly what happened, because Clinton's campaign didn't focus on those people. In fact, Chuck Schumer said the Democratic strategy kind of was to avoid working class Democrats in the middle of Pennsylvania and focus on getting moderate Republicans in the suburbs of Philadelphia. And she didn't visit Wisconsin at all from the primary to the general election. And her campaign ignored advice that was coming on the ground from Michigan that things were going really badly there and they needed to send people and they needed to start doing a serious job to capture Michigan voters. And those four states really did make the difference in the general election. So that's a huge part of it. But it goes a little beyond just bad strategy, because there is something about Clinton herself and the kind of politics that she represented to begin with. I mean, the reason that they were unable, that they didn't formulate that strategy, was not just a simple mistake. It was a product of a kind of mentality that's developed in the Democratic Party over the past 20 years, which has seen itself less and less as the party of the working class, and has seen itself more and more as the party of the middle class, and especially the coastal upper middle class. And the party apparatus has been dominated by people who are very well educated, who live in America's big cities. And so the center of the Democratic Party has gone from like churches in Detroit and union halls in Indianapolis to tech companies in Silicon Valley and, you know, media people in New York. And that's a shift that has meant that while the Democrats are doing fantastically well in California, for example, and in New York, they are losing everywhere. This is not just about Hillary Clinton. They're losing state governments nearly everywhere else. So it's not just that Hillary Clinton took a few wrong steps, but it really is that the Democrats have abandoned a certain kind of politics, a working class and grassroots politics, and that has resulted in massive electoral defeat over the course of the last 8 years, which culminated in Hillary Clinton's loss. And they talk a lot about how she won the popular vote, but the reason she won the popular vote is because they're doing so well in New York and California. If you subtract those states out, she didn't do nearly so well. So there's really a kind of fundamental problem with the way Democrats have started to approach politics.
Now, of course, on the other hand, we could also point to the gross fact of gerrymandering, which has made it
Yes.
much more difficult, as well as the role of voter suppression and outright hacking
Yes.
of voting machines. So while I thoroughly agree with your analysis and think it's vitally important, I have a little trouble juggling that other part, too, because it does speak to, you know, our need for electoral reform.
Yes, absolutely. And I don't diminish that. And I think we should absolutely focus on voter suppression and make a major issue out of it where it occurs. You know, one of the things that I talk about in the book is everything has a million causes, and we need to focus on the reason I'm so critical of the Democratic Party's philosophy and approach is not because I don't think there are other things, external things, that caused Hillary Clinton's loss. Like, I do think James Comey's letter the last few days of October, that seemed to make a difference in the polling, but it's the sort of difference that you can't really control. You can't affect what James Comey does. You can only affect what you do. And so we can definitely blame the fact that Republicans have gerrymandered districts to the point where that makes it much more difficult for Democrats to be elected. That's absolutely true. But the reason I focus on what Democrats are doing wrong is because that's the stuff Democrats can change. Democrats can't make Republicans stop being Republicans. We have to figure out what we can do in order to get them out of power. And we can't affect what the FBI does. We can't affect what Russia does. We can't really affect what Republicans do. But we can definitely look at what we do and change that.
Nathan Robinson. We'll talk more with him about his book, Trump, Anatomy of a Monstrosity, after the break. Stay tuned.
The beast in me is caged by frail and fragile bars, restless by day and by night, rants and rages at the stars. God help the beast in me.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Nathan Robinson today about his book, Trump, Anatomy of a Monstrosity. Before the break, we began to discuss why Hillary Clinton failed to stop Trump. But Clinton's weakness as a candidate was not the sole factor. I asked Nathan Robinson about problems in the electoral strategy of the Democratic Party, the so-called Schumer strategy, a strategy that Keith Ellison, who Schumer now supports, is mounting a challenge to in his bid for chair of the DNC.
What we call the Schumer strategy was almost the Bill Clinton 1992 strategy and the DLC, Democratic Leadership Council strategy, which is there's this kind of philosophy that some moderate, sometimes called neoliberal Democrats have, which is, okay, the way to win is to forge a coalition between liberals and moderates, including moderate Republicans. So you have a centrist Democratic Party because your base is never going to vote for the Republican candidate. But moderate Republicans, if you have a moderate appeal, might vote for you. And so that's what Chuck Schumer was saying. We'll just try and pick up these Republicans. And it's a strategy that worked phenomenally well for Bill Clinton in 1992 and 1996. It did not work for Hillary Clinton. And one of the reasons that this didn't work is that Hillary Clinton's campaign seemed to think that the people to her left, the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, they could be taken advantage of, they could be taken for granted because they weren't going to vote for Trump because Trump was crazy. And so if you pointed out that Trump was crazy and unhinged, they would have to vote for her because they had no choice. And moderate Republicans who found Trump too vulgar and unhinged would also vote for her. And that would be a winning coalition. Well, it turns out that first, moderate Republicans don't really like Hillary Clinton. So that wasn't going to work because she doesn't have the same kind of appeal that Bill Clinton did. And also, you can't take people on your left for granted necessarily. Those people who the Bernie Sanders movement represented a profound disillusionment by, he got 13 million votes, a profound disillusionment by 13 million people with the party apparatus. And a lot of those people, now very few of them ended up voting for Jill Stein, but a lot of those people stayed home. A lot of those people voted for Clinton only grudgingly, because they genuinely didn't like either option, and they didn't feel that the strategy that the Clinton campaign chose of, well, it's me or Trump and I'm not Trump, people said, well, I don't like either of you, I'm not going to vote. And so, I mean, Hillary Clinton thought she could rely on, like, black voters who would be turned off by Trump's racism and progressives. But at the same time, she didn't do much to appeal to the progressive wing of the party. She deliberately chose Tim Kaine as a vice presidential candidate who was as centrist as you can get, instead of choosing someone to appease the Bernie Sanders supporters. And at the end of the day, doing that turned off a lot of people. And this strategy of, like, we're gonna find the centrists. Well, it turns out that we're a very polarized country right now, and there aren't really that many centrists. It was an anti-establishment election, and if you ran on I'm the sane establishment candidate, you were going to lose.
Right. And in fact, you point out, although, that we can't, you know, hindsight is 20/20, we can't really be confident about things that didn't happen, you know, alternate history. But many people have pointed out, and you also point out too, that Bernie Sanders, in fact, won exactly those areas that went to Trump in the primary, that went to Trump in the general election.
Yeah. I mean, we don't know if Bernie Sanders would have won. I mean, I think it would have been very unpredictable. We've never seen anything. There's never been any previous election that would give us a hint as to whether that could happen. But I think there's good reason to believe that Bernie Sanders would have done better than Hillary Clinton, precisely because, as you just mentioned, the places where he did the best were those places that Democrats couldn't pick up support, were rural Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Michigan, where he had a surprise upset against Hillary Clinton. Bernie Sanders crafted his campaign around a message to the disaffected working class, and those are the people that the Democrats needed in order to win. So I think there is good reason to believe that he could have done just as well, if not better, precisely because he kind of had neutralized Trump's populist message with a populist message of his own, which Hillary Clinton was unable to successfully do over the course of the campaign.
In fact, one could probably say that, moderate Democrats would have had to have voted for Bernie Sanders instead of Donald Trump in this election, whereas a whole lot of independents and blue-collar Democrats could have gone to, went to Trump.
Right.
So now, where do we go from here? I mean, one of the criticisms is that if you, talk about working class issues, you are ignoring issues of race, of identity politics, of LGBTQ, all those things that the Democrats are good at, and that you're going to be therefore racist and homophobic, et cetera, if you do that. Is there really a contradiction between the two?
No, absolutely not. I mean, it's really unfortunate that this has been set up as some kind of dichotomy, right? Either you have to favor issues of identity and diversity, or you have to appeal to the working class. There's no reason why those things contradict one another. You can have a campaign that believes in advancing the prosperity and well-being of all people. And you have a broad coalition that is anti-racist, anti-sexist, but that also recognizes the importance of economic issues. There's this suggestion that it's either race or class. Well, it's both race and class, right? So Hillary Clinton's campaign was very good at speaking to issues of diversity and LGBT equality. At the same time, it's false to say that she was focused on race rather than class, because working class black people were not particularly enthused by the Clinton campaign and were seriously disaffected. So a politics that focuses on the working class doesn't just focus on the white working class. It focuses on getting the Democratic Party support built up in the black working class, where it has also eroded. So motivating working class voters of all races. And I think a Democratic Party politics that is concerned with being universally inclusive can triumph. And the first thing to do is to stop seeing these things as opposed to one another. And yes, it's true that some members of the white working class have prejudices, but at the same time, their economic issues are real, and it's not saying that their economic issues are your only focus. It's saying you care about their economic issues, but you don't sacrifice your commitment to advancing racial equality. And most progressives believe in both of those things, usually. I mean, unless you are a wealthy Democrat who believes in diversity but doesn't believe in improving the economic well-being of poor people, most progressives do believe in combining these two things. And it's just a matter of figuring out a message that can appeal to all people.
In fact, that's exactly what Bernie Sanders did. I mean, he got a lot of criticism that it totally ignored that he talked about racial justice issues and that he, that he had a positive message of unity that talked about what he was for. In a way, it seems almost as if his campaign is the kind of guide for Democrats at this point.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there was some suggestion that his campaign was, dominated by white people, and that it was the campaign of the white working class, whereas Hillary Clinton was the candidate of diversity. I think that's absolutely at odds with the facts. The facts are that first, it's true that Hillary Clinton won among people of color. But when you look at majorities, you fail to notice substantial minorities. So even where Hillary Clinton did the best, she won 80% of the black vote, that ignores 20% of the black vote, which is a lot of people who Bernie Sanders' message appealed to. And it also ignores the fact that everywhere in the country, there was young people young people of color were massively, overwhelmingly in support of Bernie Sanders. So it was actually, it was far more an age divide than a race divide, where younger Democrats who often face issues of debt, who face limited career prospects, those people were really taken in. People of all races were taken in by Bernie Sanders' populist appeal. And if you look at his book that he just published, Our Revolution, there's a whole section on racial justice, right? Bernie Sanders didn't ignore racial justice issues. They're a central part of his campaign. There are whole sections on policing and the unique issues that affect people of color. There's a suggestion that Bernie Sanders is an old, a classic socialist who thinks everything is class and nothing is race. I don't think you can read that book and come away with that impression, because he talks very specifically about racial issues from Flint, Michigan to the death of Eric Garner to the black-white wealth gap that are specifically racial in nature.
Yeah, and another point on the other side is also that many of the white working class voters who voted for Trump voted for Obama twice. So, you know, even if many of them are racist, they're clearly willing to put their class interest ahead of their prejudice.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. Yeah.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Nathan Robinson about his book, Trump, Anatomy of a Monstrosity. This puts me in mind, then, of just how wrong the press was. And, you know, we're facing a situation here where the press is under unrelenting attack from Donald Trump. They are the only, you know, really institution left that could provide some balance against him and the Republicans, and yet they are so profoundly discredited. So I wonder if you could talk to why they're discredited and then what can we do about it?
Yeah, I have a chapter in the book called The Press is Discredited Forever. And that's for a few reasons. The first reason is that there was just an overwhelming confidence among political commentators in the press that Hillary Clinton was going to win the election. I mean, they produced statistics that would suggest that she had a 95 or 99% chance. There would be headlines that said, Donald Trump has absolutely no chance. Don't worry, it's all going to be fine. And in doing so, they did contribute to an atmosphere of complacency that I think ended up costing Hillary Clinton the election by not sounding the alarm and motivating Democrats to go out and organize. But the other thing that they did, in addition to being so obviously wishful in predicting so confidently Hillary Clinton's victory, and they'd also failed to predict Trump's victory in the primary. But the other thing they did that they have continued to do is, it's very clear that hardly anyone in the mainstream political media likes Donald Trump. And as a result, every time a story about Donald Trump comes up, it is treated, if it's a negative story, it's treated with less skepticism than it necessarily ought to be. And, I mean, Trump himself just yesterday tweeted out a list of 16 stories since the election that were negative or anti-Republican stories that turned out to be false. And it's true that they were false. Right, it's true that a lot of people in the media, because they think that Trump is crazy, which he is, are willing to believe almost anything about Trump. Whether it's that he and Vladimir Putin are collaborating on a sinister conspiracy to take over the country, or whether it's—I mean, there are a series of things that I go through these in an article called "The Necessity of Credibility," which is about how you need to be very, very honest when you're writing about Donald Trump, because otherwise conservatives will just say, as they have been saying, well, the mainstream press is fake news, you have to listen to us, we're the only ones you can trust. And so I think there is a necessity to make sure that you bring the same amount of skepticism to anti-Trump stories that you bring to anything else. And I think the press may have failed to do that. There really was over the course of the election, especially with the Russia stuff, which I think a lot of that is really overblown, that really ends up making people turn off the people that you need to be able to trust the press. And so I think the press needs to do a better job going forward of being more restrained in its predictions and more scrupulous in its checking of whether something is true before it spreads an alarming rumor about Trump being on the verge of invading Mexico or anything of the like.
And so finally, we talked a little bit about what the Democratic Party has to do. Do you have other suggestions about that? And also, what can we ordinary citizens do to advance progressive values? Because it seems that if we spend all our time criticizing Donald Trump, then nobody knows what we're for.
Yeah, exactly. So the first thing that we have to do is recognize that there are problems with Democratic and progressive politics, right? Recognize that we've lost a lot of power at every level of government, and that it means we're doing something wrong. Nancy Pelosi just came out and said, well, she doesn't think that Democrats need a new direction. Well, I think that's suicidal thinking, right? The first thing that needs to be recognized is something needs to be done very, very differently. And then we ought to think about, I think, what it is that we truly stand for. Because what Hillary Clinton did that I think was the major error was portraying herself as standing for not being Donald Trump. She ran ads that said he was dangerous Donald, he couldn't be trusted, she was the stable and experienced one. But nobody really got a sense of what she wanted to do. There was no thing that she really promised to do that people got a sense of. So we want a sense of what it is we are trying to do. What do we stand for? What are the problems that we're trying to solve? And go back to examining our values, which are that we want to make life better for people, for all people. That means that we want to protect people from being deported, who have lived lives in the country for dozens of years and who are hardworking and decent people. It means that we want people not to be under crippling debt burdens. It means that we want people to have good jobs and satisfying work and to live fulfilling lives and to have good health care and schools. And it means that we want there not to be a vast mass incarceration apparatus that ensnares 1 in 3 young black men. And there are reasons that we believe in those things. And we should go back and examine why we believe what we believe and what we stand for. And that will keep us from getting distracted by things like whatever Trump tweeted in the past 24 hours or whatever silly comment is made by a Republican. We need to focus on a positive message, building a coherent and positive Democratic message, building a party apparatus that is not run from the top down but from the bottom up, which incorporates people, which encourages people to become members of the Democratic Party, to participate in politics in their everyday lives, and that really does seem to stand for something that people can get behind and that people like and that will ultimately win.
I guess the cynic in me says that, they're the people who run the Democratic Party don't really care about making the lives of everyone better. And I say that at the same time that I'm in the Democratic Party and working to make it more the kind of party that you spoke about. But what about third parties? What about changing the way elections are done entirely?
Yeah, so I think it's a reasonable question to discuss whether the Democratic Party can be saved or whether third parties are the root. I'm skeptical of third parties because I think it takes a lot longer to build a viable third party than to take over an existing party. What the Republicans and the Tea Party did to the Republican Party was they just infiltrated the party and threw out the establishment and took it over. And it turns out that a complacent party establishment is actually very weak and vulnerable and can be taken over very fast. Bernie Sanders probably went through this dilemma himself because he is not a Democrat, as Democrats sometimes point out. He has been an independent in the Senate for a long time, or he just became a Democrat. And so he chose to run in the primary and try to win the primary rather than running as a third-party candidate. And I think that was the right approach, because if you're running in a third as a third party, you might get 5% of the vote, but 5% of the vote is never going to win. You're always going to be, like, no matter how impressive your returns are, it's going to take decades to build a third party that can win at the national level. Now, I think that may be different at the local level. I think, I mean, the Green Party nearly won the San Francisco mayor's election a few years back. They used to have a lot of elected offices around the country, and I think building a viable Green Party might well be an option at those levels of government. But ultimately, if we divide progressives between the Democrats and a third party, I think that's going to hurt the future of progressive politics. And personally, I think the best strategy is for progressives to try and take over the Democratic Party apparatus, because Bernie Sanders showed that you could almost do it. I mean, he came from nowhere and nearly won the presidential primary, and probably would have won if he'd gotten a few more points in Iowa and the momentum that came from winning Iowa. So I understand why people are disillusioned with the Democratic Party and why they might want to go to third-party politics. But what I'd ask those people is to think about what the actual strategy is for how they think a third party can get into power, because it's about ultimately getting into power and getting your agenda accomplished.
Well, Nathan Robinson, this is just a terrific book. And also, it is just a terrific book to read. It's a page-turner, I would say, and I think that's the first political book I've ever read that is a page-turner.
Well, thank you. I'm very flattered. Yeah, it's hard to write a non-fiction political book that is actually bearable to read.
It's Anatomy of a Monstrosity. I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's
Thank
Voice.
You. Thank you.
Nathan Robinson is Editor-in-Chief of Current Affairs. Go to writersvoice.net for links to his recent articles, as well as his piece about the press, The Necessity of Credibility, which became part of his book, Trump, An Anatomy of a Monstrosity. Nathan Robinson is Editor-in-Chief of Current Affairs. Go to writersvoice.net for links to his recent articles, as well as his piece about the press, The Necessity of Credibility, which became part of his book, Trump, An Anatomy of a Monstrosity. And now here's a poem for today. Parnesha Jones reads her poem, What Would Gwendolyn Brooks Do?
Dawn oversees percolating coffee and the new wreckage of the world. I stand before my routine reflection, button up my sanity, brush weary strands of hair with pomade, and seal cracked lips of distrust with cocoa butter and matte rouge. I ready myself once again for mourning and mortify. Stacking poetry and bills in a knapsack, I bundle up hope. It's brutal out there. For a moment, I stand with ghosts and the framed ancestors surrounding me. I call out, hoping she can hear me, over the day-breaking sirens, hoping she's not far away, or right down the street, praying over another dead black boy. How will we make it through this, Miss Brooks? Hold on. When she held a body, she saw much worse than this. I know she was earshot and fingertip close to oppression. She saw how hateful hate could be. She raised babies, taught stone rangers, grew a natural, and rode around critics. She won a Pulitzer in the dark. She justified our kitchenette dreams and held on. She held on to all of us. Hold on, she whispers. Another day, when I have to tiptoe around the police and passive-aggressive emails from people who sit only a few feet away from me. Another day of fractured humans who decide how I will live and die. And I have to act like I like it so I can keep a job, be a team player, pay taxes on it. I have to act like I'm happy to be slammed, severed, and swindled. Otherwise, I'm just part of the problem, a rebel rouser and rude. They want me to like it, or at least pretend. So the pretty veils that blanket who we really are, this complicated history, can stay pretty and veiled like some desert belly dancer who must be seen but not heard. Hold on. We are a world of lesions. Human has become hindrance. We must be stamped and have papers. And still, it's not enough. Ignorance has become powerful. The dice that rolls our futures is platinum, but hollow inside. Did you see that, Miss Brooks? Do you see what we've become? They are skinning our histories, deporting our roots, detonating our very right to tell the truth. We are one step closer to annihilation. Hold on, she says, 2 million light years away. She's right. Hold on, everybody. Hold on, because the poets are still alive and writing. Hold on to the last of the disappearing bees and that Great Barrier Reef. Hold on to the one sitting next to you, not masked behind some keyboard. The one right next to you. The ones who live and love right next to you. Hold on to them. And when we bury another grandmother or another black boy, when we stand in front of a pipeline, pour another glass of dirty drinking water, and put it on the dining room table next to the crepla, bratwurst, tamales, collards, and dumplings that our foremothers and fathers, immigrants, brought with them, so we all knew that we came from somewhere, somewhere that mattered. When we kneel on the rubbled mosque, sit in massacred prayer circles, holding on is what gets us through. We must remember who we are. We are worth fighting for. We've seen beauty. We've birthed babies who've only known a black president. We've tasted empathy and paid it forward. We've GoFunded from wrong to right. We've marched and made love. We haven't forgotten, even if they have. Karma is keeping watch. Hold on. Hold on, everybody. Even if all you have left is that middle finger around your God-given right to be free, to be heard, to be loved and remembered. Hold on and keep holding.
And that was poet Parnesha Jones reading What Would Gwendolyn Brooks Do? That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Our webmaster is Bill Way.